very difficult for the Trump administration to find common ground internationally in Latin America.
And let me get Mark Weisbrot's response as we wrap up.
Is one way to do that.
Danielle, let me get Mark's response as we wrap up.
Sure.
Yes, well, I think that, again, the most important thing is that it's still a polarized country. You know, Daniel mentioned the 21% approval rating. That's about where it's been for a year. I mean, imagine people saying that the president is doing a good job when there's 500% inflation, a deep depression, and shortages of food and medicine. Why is that? Again, it's because there are a lot of people who still, first of all, there's millions of people who actually appreciate what the 10 years of progress that they had under Chavez. Secondly, they're afraid of what might happen to them if a right-wing government takes power in a coup. And so, that's why it's so important to have negotiations. That's why you need constitutional guarantees. Whoever loses the next presidential election doesn't face a government that controls all three branches of government and uses it to persecute them. I think those are the things that are going to have to happen.
We have to leave
it
there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Danielle Lansberg-Rodriguez speaking to us from Chicago at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, and Mark Weisbrot, Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Laura Gottesdiener. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO. It is 5 o'clock, and up next is the news.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasures to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for your community radio station, KBOO. Bring them to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Friday, August 11th. Please, no home-recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. The KBOO Book and Record Sale will be held on Saturday, August 19th. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213. KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dingo, is showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. Miles Davis made his only acting appearance in this film about a jazz trumpeter who dares to realize his musical dreams in the Australian outback. The film also has an award-winning Miles Davis soundtrack.
Did you like the music?
Again, that's Dingo, showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Gotta go now, Joe, before they take off and leave me. Nice meeting you.
And this KBOO program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Chamber Music Northwest, presenting the five-week-long 2015 Summer Festival starting June 26th, with a special focus on women composers in Week 3, July 10th to 16th. From Hildegard von Bingen in the 12th century to up-and-coming women composers in the 21st, schedule and details are on the Chamber Music Northwest website at cmnw.org.
KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced today that the revised edition of the Republican health care bill will be unveiled this week.
Our 45th president's son has been called to testify about his meeting with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya.
And on tonight's In Depth, Belinda Carroll from Portland's Queer Comedy Festival talks about the ins and outs of keeping the LGBTQIA community laughing. We'll be right back.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 11th, 2017. I am Tony.
And I'm Jenna. The Jansen Beach Center, a familiar mall to old Portlanders that housed a 1921 C.W. Parker carousel, has finally sold to the Kimco Realty Corp. Kimco purchased the Portland Mall to the tune of over $131 million. Kimco said the acquisition of the 67-acre lot could allow 4 to 6,000 square foot buildings that include mixed-use opportunities. This means that the Jansen Beach Center could one day be home to apartments and office space. The mall will join Kimco's 8 other strip mall-like properties in the metro area, including the Clackamas Promenade, Tansborn Village, Sunset Mall, and Gresham Town Fair. The company has managed to develop hundreds of shopping centers coast to coast in the U.S. There has been no mention of the Jansen Beach's beloved carousel. It remains a mystery after disappearing during a mall remodel in 2012.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced today that the revised edition of the Republican health care bill is expected to be unveiled on Thursday and planned for a vote on it next week. The bill has been under fire by Senate Democrats for the secretive nature in which it was drafted and the fact that it is planned to be voted on without any committee hearings first. The new plan has also been greatly criticized by many as nothing more than a tax cut for the very wealthy. A previous version of the plan was put before Congress last May but did not have the votes needed to pass. A few dissenting Republicans, including Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, would not support the earlier bill because it wasn't conservative enough.
Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, is calling for Donald Trump Jr. to testify about his meeting with Russian lawyer Natalia Valinskaya, who is rumored to have ties with the Kremlin. The June 2016 meeting was brokered by a business associate of Donald Trump, Bob Goldstone, and was the hope of receiving damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was also present at the meeting, along with Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. This meeting is being looked on as a clear evidence of top Trump campaign members meeting with Russians to obtain such information and could be violation of federal election laws. Along with Senator Warner, Senator Susan Collins of Maine has also called for Trump Jr. to testify under oath before the committee. Representative Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, has also made a similar demand.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Joanne Powers. The lowest-wage workers in St. Louis are getting a pay cut thanks to Republicans in the Missouri legislature. After the city passed an increase in the minimum wage to $10 an hour in 2015, the legislators passed a so-called preemption law, which prevents municipalities from setting a minimum wage any higher than that of the state. Effective August 28th, St. Louis's poorest workers will get a pay cut of 23%. The state's Republican governor, Eric Greitens, didn't sign the law, but chose to allow it to become law anyway by not attempting to veto it. Wanda Rogers, a McDonald's fast food worker involved in the fight for 15 and a union, says that workers were struggling at $7.70 an hour.
$10 an hour, it made it a little easier for us. How can you give us some and then just come and snatch it back from us? McDonald's is a $1 billion corporation. They can afford to pay us $15 an hour for real. We really do some hard work, and for y'all to come back and take this $10 from us, I don't think it's fair. I wonder if they can live off of $7.70 an hour. It's really going to be heartbreaking, and it's really going to hurt us for them to come back and just snatch that from under us like that. I'm not going to accept it. We're going to keep on fighting until we get what we deserve and what we work hard for.
The National Employment Law Project is calling out the so-called gig economy, app-based companies such as Uber, for contributing to racial inequality in our economy. Nayantara Mehta of NELP says a lot of the problems facing these workers stems from misclassifying them as independent contractors.
What a lot of these gig companies are doing is saying, we're going to dictate a lot of your working life and working conditions, but we're going to call you an independent contractor. All of the things that most of us associate with the protections of having a job, that we get paid a minimum wage or are protected from discrimination. We are able to collectively organize as workers. All of these things happen if you are classified as an employee.
Independent contractors are exempt from protections of the Civil Rights Act. In addition to direct discrimination, Meta notes biases in the customer rating systems companies such as Uber use to rate their workers.
Whether they are explicitly biased or they have the invisible but pervasive biases that we know exist in our society, they apply those biases when they're rating their drivers. And drivers of color are therefore more likely to receive lower ratings. Our biggest concerns with the gig economy reflect our concerns with the economy in general, which is that workers are exploited and the most vulnerable workers, often workers of color and immigrant workers and low-paid workers, are especially vulnerable. It's really important for us to hold these companies accountable to make sure that these companies don't get away with replicating the inequalities and discrimination that we see too often.
To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A report released today by the human rights group Amnesty International accuses the Iraqi army and its allies, including the U.S., of possible war crimes in the Battle of Mosul. A U.S.-backed coalition provided air support to a 100,000-strong ground force as it fought to retake the northern Iraqi city from the self-declared Islamic State, or ISIS. ISIS took the city 3 years ago after routing an unprepared Iraqi army. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi declared victory in the city yesterday. Amnesty's report also blames ISIS for the untold civilian casualties, especially for their policy of forcing civilians to remain in place as human shields, even as their neighbors were targeted by coalition bombs. However, the main target of the report is the coalition and the Iraqi army. It says that despite the difficulty of avoiding civilian casualties, more action should have been taken to minimize them. On many occasions, for example, the coalition dropped leaflets warning of impending bombardment. These warnings were of little use to civilians as they were held in place at gunpoint. The watchdog group Air Wars estimated that over 3,700 civilians died in West Mosul alone from government and coalition attacks. Amnesty states that it believes this number to be much higher and that given the destruction, shifting population densities during the battle and heat, the true number may never be known.
Turkish officials are claiming that ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has most likely been killed after Syrian opposition fighters reported that ISIS confirmed his death in the town of Tal Afar. It is believed that al-Baghdadi was killed in a Russian airstrike in late May on a meeting near the outskirts of the town. It is estimated that over 300 other fighters and ranking ISIS commanders were also killed in the missile strike. Officials have been hesitant to announce Baghdadi's death as he has been thought to have been killed in the past, only to turn up again. However, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Oleg Sirimulatov has announced that it is highly likely that he was killed in the strike, and senior Russian military figures are also saying they are convinced that Baghdadi is dead.
And now we'll hear from Rick Smith and Archives of Labor History.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. The little steel strike was beginning to collapse. Strikers in Massillon, Ohio had gathered that Sunday night at union headquarters across from Republic Steel's Massillon Works. As Ahmed White describes in his book The Last Great Strike, the union had organized weekly festivities on Sunday nights, including food, live music, and dancing. For weeks, the Law and Order League had repeatedly demanded special police be deputized and armed to crush the strike. By early July, Ohio National Guardsmen ensured the forcible reopening of the mill. One self-appointed special deputy leader, Major Curley, decided tonight would be the night he was going to, quote, clean out that goddamned hall. He provocatively positioned his deputies in front of Union headquarters. First, he ordered his deputies to fire on picketers attempting to block the gate at shift change. When strikers hurled bottles and rocks in response, the deputies unleashed massive rounds of gunfire and tear gas for more than half an hour. Guardsmen, railroad, and company police joined in the anti-SWAC siege. Two strikers were dead. Nick Valdos was shot in the hip as he attempted to aid wounded strikers. Fulgencio Calzera was shot in the back of the head in front of union headquarters. Another seven strikers were shot and seriously wounded. At least four more were hospitalized with injuries. Police forces ransacked the hall, seizing union records and membership lists. They continued their rampage through the neighborhood, ransacking homes and arresting anyone suspected of having ties to the union. As many as 165 were arrested and held for several days. As White notes, the NLRB and the La Follette Commission both concluded that blame for the evening's violence lay with Republic. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Okay. One moment, please. Should I just start reading?
Today on DI Squared, we meet Julie Derrick of JD Shoes, a repair shop on North Abita here in Portland. With Julie R. Nita Shaw and Saksang Davies of Meso Micro Enterprises Services of Oregon, a nonprofit that works with startup and businesses.
Welcome to DI Squared, a 10-part weekly feature of KBOO News. DI Squared stands for Dream It, Do It. Today we present Episode 6. Have you ever had an idea about a product or a service that you thought could be a big hit in the marketplace? Have you ever wondered, could I make a living doing something I really like doing? This is the sixth in our 10-part series that's designed to help you understand the basics of starting a business and whether you might want to think about doing that. We've been focusing on minority businesses, mostly people of color. Last week, we talked with Dimas Diaz, who came from Cuba in 1981 and now sells commercial insurance. Today, we meet a woman who came from Idaho and now repairs shoes. Julie Derrick repairs shoes at a store in North Portland. Julie started her business 7 years ago, and she's been growing it, slow but sure, ever since. She got some help from an organization called MISO, Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon, which has an office in North Portland. Julie's here at KBOO today, along with Nita Shaw and Tatsonga Davis of MISO, to describe how Julie launched her business and how MISO helped her and maybe could help you. Julie, tell us your story.
I started the shop because I had been laid off. I did some research and found that shoe repair shops and auto repair shops were actually growing.
Where's your shop and what's your website?
The website is www.jdshoerepair.com, 728 North Alberta.
You got some help in getting started. Tell us about that.
I felt like I had enough basic skills in the trade itself to start taking in repairs on my own, but I knew nothing about running a business except what I had gleaned from working in small businesses and growing up with entrepreneurs in my family. So a friend of mine recommended that I get in touch with MISO, and I did. I went down there and talked to them about my idea, my experience, and I met with Nita, and she gave me homework to assess my seriousness, and I was pretty serious. So I did all my homework, and I knew that it was a good trade. I knew that it would work.
You must have had to put some money into it. How did you come up with that? How big an obligation was it, and how tough was it to get funds?
I think overall, I was able to start my business for under $10,000. A friend of mine had recently sold her share in a collectively owned house, and she loaned me $5,000 to buy the original set of equipment, everything. It had all the tools that I needed to get started in my shop. Through Nita, I found somebody who was renting a small space. My first rent was $250 a month, which was completely feasible. I had friends come down and do the build out, and all they wanted was food for it. My community was extremely supportive, and my family as well. Meeting with MISO folks where I started to understand that there's this thing called projections. How are you going to figure out how much money you need to make, and how are you going to make that money? And walk me through the real basics.
If you had to start again now, what would you do differently, if anything?
I feel pretty solidly about how I've run my business, although there have been some stressful times when we had to scramble to build up the infrastructure to handle the actual work, and I'm still working on that. It ebbs and flows so dramatically that it's hard to keep yourself staffed all the way for when you're going to get busy. You kind of have to keep inventing new ways to keep everything going.
If one of our listeners who's thinking of starting a business came into your shop and asked you for your advice, what would be the most important thing you could tell that person?
I would just want them to deeply assess if their concept is viable. Do people want that? I mean, can you afford to do it until you really make money? Is it something that can actually work, as to the extent that you can possibly predict that beforehand?
With us in the studio today also is the organization that gave Julie some of her early mentoring. That's the Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon. We have Tastonga Davis and Nita Shaw. Nita, you were one of the first persons that Julie spoke with. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
And what was that relationship like there at the beginning?
Well, I still remember Julie coming to MISO when we were located on Alberta. I remember her enthusiasm, her experience that she already had. And even though it was a startup business, she had a lot of the knowledge that we hope all small business entrepreneurs have. So Julie was not scared to start on her business plan. She was not hesitant to go out and do as much research as it needed. There were many challenges in financing and in finding a location, but she was up to running around and doing her own part. We are at 4008 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard. We are a corner of MLK and Shaver. We have always been in Northeast Portland since 2005 when we first opened our doors.
Tastonga, maybe you want to comment on this. How do you get your funding for MISO?
We get our funding through a variety of ways. We're state funding, federal funding, city funding, and foundations and donations.
Now, yesterday, we had in our studios here at KBOO the Small Business Administration Administrator for Portland, Marty Gold. I understand that you are connected, your organization is connected with the SBA. Is that right?
Yes, we are approved SBA lender, so we give small loans to businesses.
You give small loans to businesses, or you give loans to small businesses? Or you give small loans to small businesses? What's small? Is that $100 or $10,000 or what?
We do have several different loan products, and we do offer credit builder loans, which start off at $100. But as an SBA lender, our loans go up to $50,000. We've given loans as high as $225,000.
Julie, did you get a loan from the SBA?
I have, yes. I took out a loan to buy an upgraded set of equipment 5 years ago. I participated in the savings program, the IDA, that matches your funds, and was able to purchase some other pieces of equipment and do some advertising at a time that was important.
Nita, let me ask you, could any of our listeners just walk in your door? Is that how they would begin to get your help?
Yes, and that is what is unique about MISO, is anyone who is thinking of opening their business or already have one and are looking for resources, they can walk into MISO 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and someone is always available to sit down with them and provide needed support.
Is there any charge for them for that service?
Oh, absolutely not. We are a nonprofit and get funded to provide these services.
Tell me, what are you looking for in the person who comes through that door? What's the most important thing that will tell you that this is going to be a viable concept and a business?
If a business owner is serious and dedicated to their business, taking on the task of researching her field and being dedicated to it.
I think you said something about proving the concept. Is that the term you used earlier?
Yes. If it's a startup business that's coming through the door, we do sit down and kind of walk through their business plan with them and give them some work to do after they meet with us. If they come back and they're still with it and they've done all the things that we've asked and they show that dedication, we continue working with them. And that's how they really become successful.
Many of our listeners, or some of them, would probably say, look, I don't have a built-up capital. I've been working in 9-to-5 job that pays $8 an hour for 5 years. My credit rating is questionable. Can I get started? Can I get a loan? Can I get some help?
If they have credit that needs enhancing, MISO will sit with them and give them really small loans to start getting their credit established once again. You know, if you walk in the door and say, I want $50,000, that's not going to be possible. We're going to have to make sure that you have a business plan, that your strategies are pretty tight, but we will at that time help them get set up for future success in financing.
The market research was extremely helpful a couple of different times. In the beginning, it helped me do some targeted mailings to folks in the neighborhood to let them know there was a shoe repair shop there. And then more recently, now that the business is pretty well established, I went through a process of market research as far as who can I be reaching that I'm not yet. So they pulled up a whole report, and one of the staff members at MISO worked with me to develop a plan, a marketing plan, and then we'll continue to check in as I go through the stages of that plan that we developed. I would just say, from the perspective of the entrepreneur, that when you get into something like this with MISO or whomever you choose to seek out for support, you really avail yourself of all the services that are there for you. Because I technically graduated from MISO 4 years ago, but I'm still in constant communication with the staff people. And because of the microloans, they review my financials on a quarterly basis. So I sit down with somebody on staff and we go through everything. It just makes me feel like I can't fail.
That was Julie of JD Shoe Repair, who repairs shoes at her shop on North Alberta, along with Nita Shaw and Tatsonga Davis of MISO, Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon. Next week, we meet a husband and wife business team who make new things out of old books. They're makers and recyclers who found a way to make a living while working out of the home. Their story may open a new chapter for you. That's it for DI Squared for today. Thanks for listening. If you want to review what you've heard just now, go to kboo.fm and look under Evening News for today's date, or look in KBOO's podcast section for episodes of DI Squared. We'll be back in a week. Tune in then for the next episode of DI Squared. Dream it, do it. From KBOO News, I'm Tom Flynn.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth featuring special guest Belinda Carroll from the Portland Queer Comedy Festival. At 6, it's Preference, a queer experiment in radio with Alan Silverman. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather in the Portland metro area will be clear with lows and winds at 7 miles an hour with temperatures hovering around 68 degrees. Tomorrow's weather calls for sunny and 83 degrees in Portland, 90 and crystal clear in the Dalles and in Hood River, and 59 and clear in Lincoln City. Today in history, the abandoned U.S. space station Skylab made a stunning return to Earth, burning up in the atmosphere and showering debris over the Indian Ocean and Australia. The quote of the day is from a joke reportedly written on a wall in a hall at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in California after it lost contact with the Mars Polar Lander in December 1999. It said, quote, "We have your satellite. If you want it back, send $20 billion in Martian money. No funny business or you will never see it again."
And now, we hear from our friends at Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Boulder, Colorado is a national leader in urban sustainability, from its water conservation efforts to its early adoption of curbside recycling. Now the city is tackling global warming pollution. By mid-century, Boulder plans to reduce its carbon emissions 80% below 2005 levels. Brett Kincairn, Boulder's Senior Environment and Climate Coordinator, says reaching the goal will require big changes.
There's no way we can achieve deep emissions reduction unless we dramatically decarbonize our electricity sources.
So the city also committed to using 100% clean electricity by 2030.
We're looking at dramatic adoption strategy and campaigns around solar, especially in the commercial sector.
Updated city codes now require that new commercial buildings are wired for solar panels, and new homes above a certain size must generate as much clean energy as they use. To help, Boulder will provide incentives.
We spend money on fossil-based energy every day. And if we think about using the money that we're already spending in different ways, it actually opens up a whole series of new opportunities.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Kevin Levy was just an average Joe, completely infuriated over the inequity he and his community were experiencing. He was so frustrated about the lack of awareness that instead of screaming, he decided to start the Revolution Choir. The Revolution Choir is a Portland area choir that just opened for the multicultural festival Good in the Hood. The choir sings original songs of resistance that are about equal pay for equal work, money in politics, universal health care, income inequality, climate change, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ rights, honoring women, fair elections, gerrymandering, and many other topics. The Revolution Choir believes that music is by far the most powerful way to spread messages and that 20 voices are stronger together than one. Founder Kevin Levy and the choir visited KBU Studios recently. KBU's Zelis Marchant was there to find out more.
Welcome, Revolution Choir and Kevin.
Hello.
Hello.
So good to be here at KBU. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming. So how long has Revolution Choir been around?
You know, I think we're coming on 5 months.
I'm really shocked about that.
Yeah.
I feel like I think we've talked a little bit about this. I feel like there's got to be several years under your belt so far.
You know, our singers here, like, they just sound amazing, and they're just pulling it together, and just a lot of great friends of mine, and
awesome.
Have great vocal cords.
You're making waves. 5 months.
Tidal cord waves.
So you're going to regale us with a song.
Our first song we are going to do is Overworked and Underpaid.
All right.
When I wake in the morning, I just lay in bed and close my eyes, 'cause my bones I'm so tired, I can't hide.
is pretty fantastic. So, are you writing all the material yourself? Is that right? Everybody,
correct.
Do you have think tank sessions where you get together and you're like, what awful thing happened in the news this time that we need to write a song about?
It's a little bit of both. I love hearing feedback from certain choir members that just will give something off their heart, and then I kind of come home into my garage and late at night pull up the guitar and start writing songs. And
I love that picture you just painted. Are there choral openings right now? Do you accept more choristers, or is it a special club? I don't know.
That's such a great question. If you are a first soprano, or if you are a deep bass, we would love for you to contact us. Kevin Levy, I'm the man. Contact me.
Okay. Great. Without further ado, let's dive into another song.
Our next one is Love Conquers Hate.
Don't you know?
Kevin Levy and Revolution Choir for taking time to come in and sharing your songs of resistance with our community and our audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and news tips at 503-231-8032. Our production teams for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Sam Bowman, and Tom Flynn. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Aaron the Majestic Yankee. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Directors is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenna.
I'm Tony. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. At 9, On the Ground Radio says No New War, with voices of Koreans, Korean-Americans, and anti-war activists who are calling for a final end to the decades-old Korean War. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Dirtbag looks at ways to conserve soil moisture, summer pruning, and grafting during the dry season. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Have a good night, Tony.
You too.
Night, Aaron.
Majestically night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The first annual Portland Queer Comedy Festival kicks off July 13th with events at the Funhouse Lounge, Curious Comedy Theater, Crescent Ford Food and Drink, as well as many other satellite stages. The festival runs 4 days, spotlighting comedians that fall under the LGBTQIA spectrum and their allies. It's the festival's vision to highlight queer and allied talent from all over the world, but to also give back to the queer community through the festival's nonprofit initiatives. We have in the studio with us right now Dee Martin Austin.
Hi.
From the Portland Queer Comedy Festival. Welcome.
Sorry, my voice is very loud. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming to KBOO. So, you know, let's just jump right in. Who is on the talent roster for the festival?
It is thrilling. We have tons of comics from across North America, but our headliners are Guy Branum, Ant, Kate Willett, Jason Stewart, Riley Silverman, Jeffrey J., Julie Goldman, Robbie Hoffman, and Maggie May.
So it's just like a little bit of a short list of, oh my God.
Yeah, just a who's who of national headlining LGBT comics.
And how many how many people are on the roster just throughout the whole entire festival?
It is well over 40 comics.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, wow. That's so you have quite a few. When they say satellite stage, there's going to be quite a few locations that this will be taking place in the city.
Yeah. We had to branch out to fit in everyone's shows.
And so do you have any personal favorites that you're looking forward to during the festival?
Oh, I don't know if I can comment on that exactly, but Guy Branum is doing his signature show, Gay Bash, which is going to be amazing. Jeffrey J. and friends, we're doing a special edition of Funhouse Lounge's show, Comic Strip. So, yeah.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the origins of the festival? This is the first year of the festival, correct?
Yes.
So how did this concept come about?
Well, our executive producer, Belinda Carroll, has years of experience as an activist within the local LGBT community, and she just always dreamt of combining her two passions of activism and comedy, and this is how we brought them together. So we joined forces with Funhouse Lounge, who is fronting a lot of the initial funds, I think I can say that, So yeah.
So it sounds like you have quite a bit of support from the different venues and probably from different organizations around
exactly.
Portland.
Exactly. And fortunately, Belinda happened to have contact information for many of our headliners, so they were thrilled to join us.
Well, how long has this planning been in the works for now for you guys?
As far as my part, a few months. As far as Belinda's, I think she's pretty much been dreaming this up for years. So it's just now happening.
So where? What are these other stages, other performances? Is everything stand-up comedy? What are the different things that will be happening?
It's mostly stand-up comedy. I know there is one improv show, and my podcast, Your Fault for Listening, will also have a special recording at Ford Food and Drink Saturday evening at 7:30.
What is your podcast about?
My podcast, I have stand-up comics perform their actual sets, and then I more or less interview them based on the contents of their own jokes.
How very interesting.
Yes.
I'm sure you get many interesting insights in asking those kinds of questions. We'll just put it that way.
Yes, yes.
Stuff that happens on podcast, but not on radio.
Exactly. It flourishes on going off the rails.
So this comedy festival is very much something that is a personal thing for you as well, that it's very much an interest.
Oh, yes. Yes. I'm couldn't be happier.
And so I'm wondering, as someone who is interested in comedy in general, what do you think this is helping to do for the queer community here in Portland in terms of just visibility and just creating a sense of community?
Well, this is, I believe, the largest LGBT-focused comedy festival that has occurred in America. So that's a pretty big deal. We're also donating several funds to various charitable organizations, including Smirk, Butch Voices, Transactive. So, yeah. Sorry. Belinda's sending me text messages as we go. she wanted me to know.
Oh, so she's listening. She's
yes,
listening
exactly.
Right now.
She's stuck behind a train in case anyone's wondering why I'm doing all the talking. It wouldn't go this way normally. Yes, our nonprofit include Planned Parenthood, Cascade AIDS Project as well. So
quite a few organizations are going to be benefiting from this.
And I am also hosting a show, QOC Block, which is a show entirely devoted to queer comics of color. And those funds, we're doing a 50-50 raffle at that show, which will benefit the NAACP.
And what day is that going to be happening?
That show, there are so many shows. I have to keep track of this myself. That is Friday night at 7 p.m. at Funhouse Lounge.
So what about volunteering for the festival? If people want to get involved, is there still
openings
for volunteers?
I believe so. Just go ahead and visit PortlandQueerComedyFestival.com. There is a volunteer page. Tickets are on sale. There are passes for the entire festival, as well as individual day passes, and tickets for specific shows just went on sale today as well.
Are shows selling out?
I certainly hope so.
Do people need to hurry up, I guess, is the question. People.
Yeah. The individual tickets are fairly limited, so you should definitely go on. And if you see a show that you are really excited about, buy those tickets now.
And so, in comedy, comedy is known for its parties. It's after parties as well. You know, you got to tell jokes all night. So are there any after parties that you know of that the community can take part of?
I am not the one to ask. I generally avoid social interaction, but I
just keep it to the podcast.
Yes, exactly. If there's not a microphone in front of me, I prefer silence.
We understand.
Yes.
You're on radio. And where can people find out, like, just how to get tickets, how they can volunteer, where can they find all the details and everything?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything can be found on PortlandQueerComedyFestival.com. All the information is there, readily available. You can look at all of our nonprofits and, find out whatever information you need.
I just want to ask you personally, what is it that draws you to comedy? And wanting to know just more about it, and you know, just wanting to take part of the biggest festival here in the United States.
Yeah. So the honest answer as far as what draws me to comedy is avoiding existential dread. But as far as the festival,
we can get into that in another show. Another type of interview.
Yes.
With a couch or something.
I generally focus very heavily on community, and that's something that Belinda and I have definitely bonded over throughout our time working together. So this festival in particular is definitely a passion project that we are pretty much banking on losing money on, but because we're donating most of the money, so it's... This is definitely just to support our community.
And for people who are maybe unfamiliar with the comedy scene here in Portland, what is the comedy scene for the LGBTQIA community like here?
It is small, but fortunately it is growing rapidly. I think word has gotten out that Portland is both sort of a progressive hub of activity and also a comedy hotspot now. So those two things are finally converging.
Portland as a comedy hotspot. Yes. So is Portland like the new Chicago or the new New
More
York?
Like the new Colorado.
The new Colorado.
Yeah, or Austin. We like to borrow from Austin, Texas a lot. So
I see.
So we're continuing that pattern. We're
kind of the artsy city that has its own quirkiness.
Yes, exactly.
It has its own, you can't quite put your finger on, but it's Portland.
Yes, exactly.
So how would you, that? What to you is the thing that is the flavor of Portland? What makes Portland comedy unique in itself?
What makes Portland comedy unique in itself? Honestly, one of the things, and I heard this from a lot of comics coming here from other cities, we have a lot of stage time. far more stage time than most cities, and we allow longer material to be done. New York, for example, is known for very rapid fire mics. LA, of course, you sit on a waiting list to see if you get on at all, whereas Portland, you can very realistically hit 5 open mics in a night. And so we develop very quickly as new comics in Portland. So you get a lot of very skilled comics here because they have the extra time to practice right away. And there's not... I was going to say there's not a lot of tolerance, but there's pretty much no tolerance at all for hate speech or just general bigotry and ignorance on stage. So we also hold our comics to a much higher standard than many other cities.
So that's what you mean when you're saying like Portland is quite a progressive place in that sense.
Yes. We expect a lot from comics here.
So does that... do you feel that that kind of puts a little pressure on comedians to, say, like, elevate their humor, or does it just attract a certain type of comedian?
I would say it both. It definitely does both. I can even say for myself, when I started, you know, I just watched HBO comedy specials or whatever and did a lot of the standard hack jokes, but learned very quickly that there was another level to be lived up to.
Well, so this festival, is going to be have the Portland Queer Comedy Festival, which we're talking about, kicking off on July 13th, is going to be bringing in comedians that are not just from the Portland area. You have, you know, national headliners.
Yes, exactly.
How do you think they will be fitting into the Portland comedy scene then?
Oh, they'll do fine. They're geniuses. Guy Branum has been here several times for Bridgetown Comedy Festival, for example. Maggie May has done All Jane Comedy Festival several times at Curious Comedy, which is one of our venues for the festival as well. So, also, Riley Silverman was on All Jane, as well as Kate Willett. So our headliners are familiar with what they're coming into and are more than qualified.
So once again, we're almost running out of time here. I want to make sure that you get a chance to repeat how people can get more information if they want to find out more.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are all the socials and the websites?
Yeah, so you can follow us on Twitter at PDX Queer Comedy Fest. There's, of course, the main website, PortlandQueerComedyFestival.com. We're all very active on Facebook and Instagram. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming in studio. That is D. Martin Austin of the first annual Portland Queer Comedy Festival, which kicks off on July 13th. How many days is it going for?
That is 4 days.
Four days.
This coming Thursday through Sunday.
And so you can catch that at various... not English. Sorry, getting all tongue twisted here. You can find that at various areas around Portland at the Funhouse Lounge, Curious Comedy Theater, Crush, Ford and Food and Drink, as well as many other places. So check out their website to find out all the different satellite locations that'll be happening at. So thank you very much, D. Martin Austin.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm sure you'll hear a lot of jokes, laughter, and all sorts of things we wouldn't have even imagined.
It's going to be a ball.
It's 4 days of just pure laughter.
Yeah.
Thank you, D. Martin Austin.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film tomorrow on Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. The documentary Tomorrow sets out to showcase alternative and creative ways of viewing agriculture, economics, energy, and education. It offers constructive solutions to act on a local level to make a difference on a global level. Instead of showing all the worst that can happen, this documentary focuses on the people suggesting solutions and their actions. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Tomorrow, Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6 o'clock and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Preference Radio, folks. It's the second Tuesday of the month. My name's Alan. I'm your host. Our guest for the evening couldn't make it. We're going to reschedule with her, and you're going to love her. She's an ex-Portlander who's doing amazing work around the country on queer and trans rights. So we're going to hear last month's show. This is going to focus on pinkwashing and Palestinian rights in the first half. Regular listeners of Preference know that International Queer Solidarity is something that's a focus for Preference. And we're also going to hear that in the second half, it's going to be a talk about Portland's Trans Pride March. The march has already happened, but I think it's worth hearing some of the focuses of the march and the rally that took place, what it is that people were really excited about. This. We don't want to lose sight of trans rights and trans safety. So we're going to hear that as well. This is Preference. Thanks so much for listening.